We're speaking with Dr. Robin Bell of Columbia University's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory about the first mapping of the bottom of the Hudson River since the 1930s. To learn more about anything you hear on this program, visit us at www.hudsonriver.vassar.edu. Coming up on the Hudson River, the eco-calendar, a soundscape of the river, and more. Next, Bell tells us about the discovery of numerous previously unknown shipwrecks, but first tells us about the sophisticated mapping methods her team is using.
We used a couple different methods. One where we just measure how deep the water is. That's multi-beam bathymetry. It's in essence the same approach you'd use as if you were counting how far away that lightning you just saw flash was. You know how everybody goes 1,000, 2,000. We're doing the same approach. We just let the sound bounce off the bottom and we time it very accurately. So that's one measurement. That's how deep the water is. The other one is trying to figure out what the nature of the bottom of the river is like by how strong the sound bounces off. Now, if I take my shoe and I slam it on my desk, you get a really sharp sound. And that's what it sounds like if the sound bounces off of the Hudson Highlands, where there's lots of really hard rock. Whereas if I slam my shoe on my floor, it's a much more muted thud because it's carpeted. And that's the same thing that happens with the sound bouncing off the water bottom, is that we can tell where it's muddy because we get a much softer return on the echo than we do with from the hard rock. So that's the other method. That's side-scan sonar.
What portions of the Hudson have you mapped, and what's the schedule for what's left to be done?
We've finished the river everywhere from the Verrazano Narrows to the Troy Dam. Everywhere that's deeper than about 6 feet. And what that means is we've actually gone out and bounced the sound off of all that part of the river. And we're in the process now of making the maps and taking the samples to confirm what we think we saw with the sound and trying to understand what the maps mean so that when we finish, we can actually say what the different habitats are, where the contaminants are. So we're in the process of interpreting the data right now.
At this point, can you tell us a little bit more, you started to, about what you found and how it varies between sections of the river?
Well, one of my favorite is the very first one we stumbled across, which is in the region that's called the Tappan Zee. When you look at it, there's a channel on one side of the river, and a lot of the river is flat. And the assumption always was that those flat, shallow parts, about 12 feet deep, were pretty muddy. But when we mapped it, we found that most of the river on the Nyack side is covered by this very acoustically reflective, this very solid material. And it turns out when we sampled it, it was covered with ancient oyster reefs that cover much of the bottom of the river. That was an absolute surprise to us. And then other places, oh, it's very varied. Everywhere the human impact is seen on the bottom of the river, very much like the impact you see when you stand in the waves at the ocean and your feet get buried. That same process is happening every time there's a bridge crossing. Or next to every old industrial site, you can see places that people have dumped stuff in the river. They show up as giant donuts that are about a foot tall, but maybe 30 to 40 feet across, where old debris has been falling in the water.
What accounts for the hole?
It's just sort of, you drop it, and the stuff in the middle, it's kind of like a crater, almost.
Now, what about the series of submerged walls that was reported in the New York Times?
Oh, that's one of my favorite, where who knows what they are, but they're about 900 feet long, and they're parallel. And they stick up about a foot above the bottom. And we've yet to figure out whether there's something about construction projects in the 1800s, or maybe if they were an ancient Indian weir. They're pretty deep. So one way to imagine that these would have been built was to imagine that sea level was 20 feet deeper. So there remain a lot of mysteries in this attic, which we don't know exactly what they are yet.
Now, of course, the shipwrecks are off limits to the public, but you did discover some shipwrecks, and in fact, there were reports that there was reasonable confidence on your team that you discovered virtually all of the shipwrecks. Can you discuss those?
That was another surprise, is it never crossed our mind that when we started mapping, looking for contaminated sediments and nice habitats for fish, that what we'd actually end up mapping were many of the ships that have ever been sunk on the river. We were very surprised in the first 40 miles we mapped that we found many things that, you know, might be sunken ships. Mind you, everything from what looks like a nice boat-like image to something that's pretty much a lump on the bottom of the river could be sunken ships.
What kind of ships and how old and what might they have been carrying?
That's one of the mysteries, is been trying to figure out how to even go about understanding and documenting what these ships are. Because have you ever been on the river after a squall or one of the big nor'easters that goes through in the fall? You often see masts sticking up. Boats still sink today. So the question is, which one of these ships is historically interesting and which one was sunk last week? We started to try and use magnetics to tell us something about the nature of the sunken ships. And that being because the newer a ship is, the more iron and metal will be on it, and the bigger signature you'll see if you were to tow an instrument that measures how strong the magnetic field is. So we've been able to determine that some have very little metal on them, or so, and hence are probably fairly old, and some seem to have a fair bit of metal, and hence are probably much more recent.
So do you think there's any buried treasure down there?
Oh, I think there are not money and gold, but I think there are some wonderful stories on the bottom of the river that we've yet to uncover, stories about maybe life before Hudson sailed up the river, stories about the Revolutionary War. I think there's some great stories.
From the Almanac, August 31st, 1995. Croton Marsh, Hudson River, mile 34. The day was hot, humid, and still. The air was filled with the scent of a salty ocean shore at low tide. I walked out along the periphery of the marsh as far as possible and found myself almost back to the uplands on the south shore. The scene was equatorial, with giant blooms of the rose mallow showing here and there, along with phragmites towering over my head. Needlefish skittered in shoals along the shore, and herons mingled with egrets as they stalked the exposed flats, stabbing here and there for fish and shrimp. Offshore, a cormorant surfaced with a small blue crab and struggled to swallow it for half a minute, finally losing the crab or just giving up. As I rounded the innermost point and found myself out of the world and surrounded by the marsh, I saw movement across the channel along the exposed shore. A few minutes of waiting and the interrupted pageant resumed. I watched through binoculars as scores of fiddler crabs crept, scurried, scuttled, waved their claws, vied for position, advanced, and retreated. The smallest seemed less than an inch long, the largest several times that size. The great claws of the males were impressive even at 75 feet. The overall impression was that the shore itself was moving, a sort of creeping carpet. I stood fascinated for almost half an hour, inhaling this secret world. Then a Metro North commuter train rumbled through, and the loudspeaker at the Austining Correctional Facility thundered across the bay. I was back in Westchester County. This observation was contributed by Christopher Letts. I'm Sean Anderson.
The Hudson River Almanac is an annual natural history journal compiled from the contributions of over 1,700 volunteers. Links on how to contribute materials or obtain copies are at www.hudsonriver.vassar.edu.
Time for the Hudson River Eco Calendar. I'm Jen Logan. A river of experience is what you'll discover at the Hudson River Regional Festival, featuring over 200 years of art, history, and music. Explore the past and present by taking part in a Dutch trading post, watching artisans working in local communities, and traveling along the river to see the views that inspired Thomas Cole and Frederick Church of the Hudson River School of Painting. You can also take in jazz and classical concerts at one of the riverfront communities, visit galleries and art exhibits, or take a leisurely walking tour. For a complete schedule of events, call 1-800-724-1846 or visit www.columbiacountyny.org. The 4th annual Hudson Valley River Ramble, scheduled for the weekends of September 20th and 21st and September 27th and 28th, will feature 125 guided walking, hiking, kayaking, canoeing, and equestrian events, as well as explorations of the Hudson River estuary by boat and on foot. Sponsored by the Hudson River Valley National Heritage Area and the Hudson River Valley Greenway, the Ramble takes place throughout 10 counties from just north of New York City to the Capital District. For a complete Ramble program guide, call 800-453-6665 or visit www.hudsonvalleyramble.com. But if you feel like actually getting out on the river, the Hudson River National Estuarine Research Reserve is sponsoring a series of canoe trips to some of the river's biggest marshes in New York State. These include Stockport Flats, a mosaic of islands and coves in Columbia County, Iona Island, nestled at the base of Bear Mountain in Rockland County, Tivoli Bay, and extensive marshes in Dutchess County. Trips include paddles devoted to learning about fish or history, and even an evening paddle. Trips are free and open to the public, though reservations are required. And you needn't have your own boat, as canoes, paddles, and safety gear are all provided. For more information, call the Hudson River National Estuarine Research Reserve at 845-758-7016. That's 845-758-7016. The Hudson Riverama is a new, permanent exhibition at the Hudson River Museum in Yonkers. The 2,500-square-foot installation features recreations of forest, marsh, and estuary ecosystems, live fish, interactive computers, videos, and a 31-foot-long, three-dimensional topographic model of the river valley. An associated 45-minute planetarium show joins two families on an Adirondack hiking trip as they learn about the Hudson's flora and fauna. For more information, 914-963-4550. That's 914-963-4550.
Next week, we speak with Robert H. Boyle, author of The Hudson, A Natural and Unnatural History, about the history of environmentalism on the Hudson and the impact it had on modern-day environmental laws nationally. We talk with Gail Godwin, longtime companion to the late Robert Starrer, about his musical composition, Hudson Valley Suite. And we hear about the migration of monarch butterflies viewed from Croton Point Park and listen to the sounds of Englewood Falls. All this and more on the Hudson River. Anaya Lockwood, who recorded the Hudson from its source to its mouth, told us that her favorite spot along her whole audio journey was in the Hudson River Gorge at Blue Ledge. On this week's Hudson River Soundscape, we listen in at that Adirondack location, famous for whitewater rafting and magnificent scenery. Hudson River Radio program is produced in association with Vassar College, its Environmental Studies program, and its Journalism Forum. Our student assistant producers are digital editor Sean Anderson and researcher and editor Batsheva Ghez. Vassar College professor Randy Cornelius is the project director. I'm your host, Mark Breslov, producer and project manager. This project has been funded in part by a grant from the New York State Environmental Protection Fund through the Hudson River Estuary Program. Special thanks to Fran Dunwell and Steve Stan of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Additional support for this program comes from Vassar College, with thanks to Susan Kuiper. Thanks also to Steve Rath. To listen to this program again or for more information, visit www.hudsonriver.vassar.edu. Email us at hudsonriver@vassar.edu.
On the Ulster hills before the British came. Oak and elm smoldered there, maples were aflame. Fields were empty, barns were full, wrapped in October haze, while British ships upriver sailed all through the golden days. As in a dream, the white sail ships past the farmlands glide, all quiet now as though in peace, northward on the tide. 2,000 men aboard those ships gaze on the golden shore. They dreamed of making homes and farms instead of making war. This was a land they could have loved and shared its homes and farms. This was a land they could have had without recourse to arms. But Kingston town was burned that day, every house but one. And it burned in the hearts of Ulster men until the war was won.